I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Sharon Booth, the author of the recently published by Fremantle Press novel, Your First, this is a long sentence, Sharon, The Silence of Water. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
On the publication of the book.
Thanks.
Tell me, I always love to find out, what's been the gestation period for the book?
Oh, goodness. It would certainly be longer than 10 years. It began, well, it actually ended up, it came about through a series of tangents with historical research. Began with something I was researching for a uni assignment, actually, and I was looking into the life of a colonial prison warder who was the ancestor of someone that I knew. And I took a few tangents with the research. This prison warder had started off in Fremantle Prison as a night warder when he'd arrived as a settler in the 1850s. And then he had risen up through the ranks and become quite a senior leader in the prison system, both the colonial system in Fremantle and the later Perth Prison in the early days of the colony. And he'd had a career that was pretty much like anybody's at the same time who was in the prison service, except for this one incident where he had been accused of basically assaulting a woman prisoner, a female prisoner in Perth Prison, him and another warder. And the charges were dismissed, and there was a two-line, like a one-and-a-half-line reference to this incident in this man's CV. And the woman wasn't named, and I hang on a minute, I want to know more about this woman. And what happened and how she, because it seemed a pretty brave thing to do, to speak up back then, any time, but particularly back then, mm-hmm. about treatment in prison.
And a senior warder.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I went to the State Records Office, the legends at the State Records Office, because I'm not a research, I was very rookie early days of research. I went to the State Records Office and I was able to find the documents relating to this complaint, and I was shocked to find that this woman, who did have a name, her name was Annie Edwards, she had written a complaint letter to the governor about the treatment that she'd said that she'd received in prison. She said that she had been dragged along the floor, she'd been treated quite brutally, she'd been thrown in the dark cell for 11 days on only bread and water. And back then, the so-called humane rule was only 7 days in the dark cell with bread and water, but it was routinely ignored. People routinely, as was found in an inquiry in the late 1890s, it was that kind of treatment was routinely abused. The woman, Annie Edwards, wasn't believed. And not only was she not believed, but across the corner of her letter, the sheriff who made the decision about her complaint hadn't even bothered to write a proper letter back to her. It was just scribbled across the corner. I don't believe her. I can categorically say that this isn't true. It is a tissue of falsehoods, because Annie Edwards was a troublemaker in prison and used a lot of bad language. And so she was completely dismissed because of these qualities. And so I just was by then forgotten all about the prison warder, and I just wanted to know about Annie. It's quite a long-winded sort of circuitous route to come to my actual novel, but I discovered that I was looking into Annie's life. I wanted to know more about her. She seemed brave. She had written this. She'd obviously really felt passionate and determined about stating her case. And the sheer weight of patriarchy and the system, she was never going to be believed. And I just wanted to know more about a woman like that, as a woman writer. Her story interested me. And I discovered that she had married, soon after she'd got out of jail, she had married a man called Edwin Salt.
So these are real people as we get
yes,
closer
yes,
to your novel.
That's right.
A real Annie, a real Edwin
yes.
Salt.
Yep.
And who's he?
Well, Edwin Salt was one of the 10,000 convicts who were transported to Western Australia between 1850 and 1868. He came out, he arrived here in 1862, and he'd committed a pretty brutal crime. When he arrived here, he got his ticket of leave quite soon after he arrived, which meant that he was able to live and work in the community. He received a conditional pardon soon after that, and he was able to start a new life here in Western Australia, as so many of those convicts, those 10,000 men, did. Edwin remarried. He married twice in Western Australia. Annie was his third wife. So by the time I had discovered, when I first discovered Annie and her connection to this man, Annie was his third wife. I discovered these things about Annie, that she'd married this man. And I just wanted to know more about how he had come to the colony. Back in the day, Western Australia, on the death certificates, it's quite interesting, on death certificates, you had to inform the authorities of how long you had been in Western Australia. So there was this general kind of anxiety about who in Western Australia, who had the right to be West Australian, or how long have we been here, that idea of legitimacy.
So if you said, and were truthful on the form, that you'd arrived in 1860, people would say, well, that's somewhere sort of in the middle of the convict transportation period.
Maybe they would, but what surprised me was that when I went into looking, because I'd run out of, I sort of reached a dead end about Annie, and so I wanted to, thought, well, maybe I can find out more about her if I follow the line of Edwin. He seemed like, oh, this is interesting. He's arrived in the mid-1860s, as you said. He's lived a life here. And I wasn't sure how to find out how he had arrived. So in the Batty Library upstairs in the city, they have these wonderful books called the Dictionary of Western Australians, where we've actually catalogued our early settlers. I looked in there, he wasn't there. And there's also another book that written by the same wonderful historians, that is basically the Dictionary of Convicts, the A to Z of all the convicts who arrived, those 10,000 men who arrived in that 18-year period.
Worries about when they get to the pearly gates. Two books, you might be in one.
That's right, that's it. And I really just checked the convict book out of thoroughness, because, and at this stage, I would have considered myself to be quite well read, but it just hadn't occurred to me that Edwin might have been a convict. And reflecting on that, I think the reason that it hadn't occurred to me was because we just, in Western Australia, we never really talk about our convicts. There were 10,000 men transported here. In the 1870s, one of the books that I read told me that in the 1870s, one in every two men in Fremantle had originally arrived here as a convict. And I remember reading this and then walking down South Terrace and looking at all those lovely, everyone having coffee and, and on the cappuccino strip, and imagine if one of every two of these blokes had a criminal past. This is really interesting. But it had never occurred to me when I began this journey that he might have been a convict, and because we just never talk about our convict stories. We talk about J.B. O'Reilly, and we talk maybe about Moondyne Joe, who has become an idea, he's become a myth, he's not even a real person any longer. But we never talk about the other guys. So when I discovered that he was a convict, and that he had come out here after committing a pretty brutal crime, and then had just had an ordinary life, I just began to think about what impact would that experience have had on him and the people around him, more so the people around him. So I began to look into his other marriage, his first marriage here in Western Australia. He married a woman called Catherine Curtin, in 1866. He had children with her. And he just lived this obscure life, but he lived a life after having been sent out. And I just began to wonder about the impact of keeping a secret of a convict past, on not only himself, but on the people around him, his wives, his children, and what might happen if anyone began to look into his life many years later, and what might happen if some of those secrets came to light. So my research began with this prison warder, but it ended up
with Edwin Salt and all
with
those around
Edwin
him.
Salt and mostly the women around him, whose stories fascinated me.
At some point, the silence of water became the setting, the vehicle, if you like, for exploring those thoughts, ideas, those queries of yours. Had you reached a point where you'd completed all the research you wanted to do about Edwin and family connected with him before you, in a sense, picked up your pen and started writing?
That's a really interesting question because historical research is fascinating and addictive, and especially when you find stories that just haven't been told before. Edwin Salt is not the kind of man that people usually write convict stories about. You know, he's not a jolly sheep stealer. He didn't have a good character. He was a bully. He was a drinker. He never took responsibility. He complained all the time. In all the records, he complained about everything that was happening to him, didn't take any responsibility, blamed everyone else for everything that had happened in his life.
You see that in the written record, do you?
Yeah. And so I did so much research. I went off on lots of tangents. It all seemed equally interesting. I was writing as I was going. I was scribbling scenes and ideas for characters as I was going. But I think the double-edged sword about research is that you can just keep going when you feel like you don't know enough yet. And one of my big fears was that the document that I didn't read, or the thing that I didn't find out, the fact that I didn't find out, would somehow be the key to the entire story. So I needed to keep researching. So in some ways it served as a fairly well-disguised procrastination tool. And what I ended up with was I built an entire world, and then the writing became paring down and cutting away.
Well, that's the beauty of it. He Edwin, has a granddaughter, Fan.
Yeah.
She has a mum, Agnes. You've got all these characters. Have you imagined all of those? Or in the course of your research, did you find descendants who had looked into a lot of this themselves?
Well, I decided to... I used only historical records that were available to everyone. And I realised that at some point I needed to draw a line with the research. And I sort of did that after I discovered that Agnes, who had left Western Australia at the age of about 18, lived in Adelaide, married there, had her children there. And then I found them somehow, inexplicably, back in Fremantle with Edwin living with them. And that's really where I thought, okay, I don't need to know any more than this now. That's real. I just need to start writing, because I had, in my imagination, I knew that there was the grandfather, the daughter and the granddaughter living in this pretty cramped house. And I just wanted to find out what would happen when a few hand grenades were thrown in. And so I kind of drew a line under it from that perspective, because I was aware I was writing fiction. I wasn't writing a biography. And that all of the information I used was available. Anyone could have done what I did. I didn't have any kind of special access to anything in particular. And in discussing this with the publishers, it was interesting to, I think, consider the fact that all of us here who are not First Nations people living in Western Australia, we've all come from somewhere else. And we all have a story of how we got here in our backgrounds. And that was an interesting kind of consideration when writing. But I think after I'd done all of that research, what I really wanted to know was what would happen when Edwin, Agnes and Fan were in the same room together and I threw in a few hand grenades. And that was really what fired me up with the writing. And that's how the story progressed.
It's wonderful the way you use Fan, because She seems like a smart, likeable, thoughtful, insightful young woman.
She's a bit of a firecracker. I don't really know where she came from, but she's a bit of a, I like her too. She's got, I wish I'd had her guts and her ability to tell it like it is when I was her age.
Well, she finds herself, they're in Allen Street of all places.
Yes, they are.
They?
Just up the road. Yep.
Where we're talking. Yep. And she starts looking into bags and boxes and things she shouldn't be looking into.
That's right, yeah.
And discovers things that make her wonder about her grandfather.
Mm.
And in some wonderful way, and grandfathers understand this, with their granddaughters, interesting relationships can develop.
Yes.
And it does in this, in this case. Did you have some model for Fan? Was it yourself? Was it...
I wish that I had been. As I said, I was not like her at all when I was young. I think I would love to have been like her. She's pretty ballsy, you know. She's pretty gutsy, and so I think I love the ocean, and I think I've given my love of the sea and swimming in the sea to Fan, although she's again much braver than me. But I'm not really sure where she came from, but I had watched my dad with his grandchildren, my sister's kids, and some of my friends' fathers with their grandchildren. I had watched how this really warm, nurturing relationships develop between grandparents and their grandkids. So I'd seen these relationships and a couple of friends who'd said, well, gee, my dad, you know, he was always a bit of a tough one. He was always a bit strict, but look at him with my kids. He's a pushover, you know. And so I had seen these lovely relationships start to develop in the lives of people around me. And I had wondered about how that would go with Fan and Edwin. And of course, Fan is pretty angry with her mum because she doesn't want to move to Fremantle. She's never heard of her grandfather before. No one's ever talked about him.
They come from Adelaide initially, don't
they? Yeah, that's right.
There's a story though along the way for Agnes in East Perth.
Yes, yeah. So Agnes has made a decision to leave Western Australia in quite a permanent way. This came about from the research. I knew that she had actually done that. She had left Western Australia at quite an early age. She'd got married in Adelaide. She'd had all her children there. And it didn't seem, from what I could find, that she was in any hurry to come back. This is what the lovely thing is about historical research, is you find the gaps, and the gaps are really interesting. I want to know, why did she come back? The only thing I can find from the records is that, well, Annie had kicked Edwin out of the house, which was, again, a pretty brave thing for a woman to do. Agnes and George, Agnes's husband, were basically, Edwin was lodging with them, and he died at their house in Allen Street. So what I had in my imagination, again, I think this is where those lovely jumping off points can happen, is I had a woman who just turned her back on Western Australia at quite a young age, gone to make a life somewhere else, and then comes back, probably reluctantly, out of a sense of family duty, or we're not really sure.
And dragging her family with her.
And the family comes too. Her husband George was a wharfie, a lumper as they were called. So I had all of that lovely material to work with. I had a wharfie who needed a job. I had a woman, Agnes, who maybe didn't want to come back. She had her children. Fan was at the age where if she wanted to be angry with her mum for picking up, uprooting her life, she could have been. And so then I just came back to this, what happens when these people are all in the house together? And so Fan, in the story, Fan is pretty angry with her mum, and she knows that she can tell that her mum and her grandfather, Edwin, Agnes and Edwin, don't get along in that way that often happens in families where nothing's ever really said, but you just know that there's a problem. And kids are really good at reading those currents, I think, in families. And And so Fan starts to try and make a friendship with her granddad, because mostly to annoy her mother. And then she finds he's got these interesting stories. He tells her about things about her own mum that she had no idea about. And she's, you know, she's a curious kid. She just wants to know. And this just wanting to know takes her into further and further uncharted territory, really.
One of the interesting things, perhaps, when you're growing up, is you can assume things about the days gone by.
Mm.
You can see some old photographs where women are dressed from neck to the toes.
Yes.
That they look like they only ever have jobs working in the home.
Mm.
That the life of a young girl or woman growing up
would
have a lot of stretches around it. And things like going for a swim would be perhaps even unheard of.
Mm.
But it probably isn't generally true, and certainly isn't for Fan, and in a way not for her mother either, is it?
No, that's right. Well, swimming, water is a big kind of, I think the ocean and the river are characters in the story, really. They have such, for Fan, the ocean is a place of safety, and she can just be herself. And for Agnes too, when she was younger, it was a place that she connects with that emotional relationship with her mother. And I discovered through some of the research that, people swimming in the ocean, Semaphore, where Agnes and Fan were living, was that kind of holiday feel. Sunday afternoons at the beach were a real thing. And so again, it just kind of, I think that became something, because I do love the water myself, it became something that I could easily work with creatively. And the two women, Agnes and Fan, they do share this love of the water, but of course Fan has never seen her mother as this side of her mother at all, and that doesn't happen. And part of the lovely, I think, Fan's journey in the novel is that she comes to know her mother in a way that she just would never have understood or expected, and that she gets to see that side of her own mum that adds a new layer to her respect and understand her love for her mother, and gives that new depth to the relationship. And same for Agnes. She learns to stop being so frightened that every time Fan leaves the house, something bad will happen to her. And so I've always seen this really as a mother-daughter story, even though, it began with the convict. For me, the heart of this story is Agnes and Fan's relationship. And water is one of the ways in which the ebbs and flows of their relationship are played out.
Well, in that sense, they both share a love of the silence of water.
I'm sorry?
They share a love of
silence
of water.
Oh, yes, they really do.
They
really do.
Yeah.
Yes, they do.
Sharon, in writing the book, was there some point, like with the long distance runner, where you were hitting a wall, and was there some point beyond that where you suddenly exulted as you came in on the wave thought that was just so wonderful?
It wasn't like the training montages in a Rocky movie or anything like that. It was there were quite a lot of dead ends, brick walls, and blind alleys on this journey. This is my first novel. I had never written a novel before, and I didn't know how to write a novel at all. I didn't know how to write this novel in particular. I spent a lot of time, very stop-start. What I think I learned along the way was that being a novelist, or writing a historical fiction from the records, is a little more than just, actually it's a lot more than just finding out what's in the records. Because I think in my early drafts, I've been reflecting on this quite a bit lately, my early drafts were terrible. They were reporting, like I was reporting on what I'd found in the archive. And it took me lots of stops and starts to understand that what was needed was a story. I needed to tell a story, and the story that spoke to me from the wealth of information that I found. It wasn't simply reporting everything that I'd found to be accurate or to be true to what I'd found. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I was as accurate and true as possible and where I could be. So there were lots of stops and starts. And this was also originally, an earlier version of this was my PhD thesis, the creative component of my PhD thesis. And that's a very structured, pressured way to approach creativity. Although I do believe that without that structure, I would most certainly never have written this book.
Well, that was going to be one of my next questions. You've got a PhD in creative writing.
Yeah.
How has that formal disciplinary activity contributed to what you've done? You've already partly answered it by saying you wouldn't have got this in the same way, at least. But for the future, when you look at yourself as a writer, what have you learnt along the way?
I think the PhD, I'm fairly certain that I would not have written this book if it wasn't for the opportunity to complete it as part of a PhD. Firstly, because of the practical and logistical aspects of being able to leave my job so I could, with a small amount of funding, it meant I didn't have to work for that period of time, for a certain period of time. It took a lot longer to finish than they gave me money. The money ran out a lot sooner than my, it took me, anyway. But it gave me that time and resources to research. And also, I was pretty frightened of writing a novel. It was like my biggest fear that I wouldn't be able to do it. And if it wasn't for the fact that I had committed to do this and there was a structure around me to make me do it,
you might have gone swimming.
I might have just quit and lived with this kind of rather tragic, dramatic, but also quite comfy idea that, well, I was never, you know, I didn't try, so I would never know if I was good enough or not. And I found the fear of writing to be really, really hard. That was my biggest kind of nemesis, was, you know, I'd had voices in my head, those negative, the inner critic. There was a whole chorus of inner critics, and I found that really, really hard. And in fact, I did actually discontinue my PhD for a number of years. I did quit, put it in the drawer, and told myself I couldn't do this. I just wasn't good enough. I didn't know how to write this story. I didn't know why this story had kind of picked me out of, it's not the kind of book I ever thought I would write. And life can get pretty hard when you're doing, you know, this kind of work. So at one point I did stop.
Well, I'm glad you didn't, because you finished up with a story. I mean, people like to use The Onion or some other fruit. I can't think of what at the moment. An orange or a mandarin doesn't help because you take off the aftermath.
Yeah, that's right. That's it. Yeah.
But you've described how you've done the research. Mm. You've got these people, and around these people, there are all of these questions. As you've said, how does Agnes finish up over there? Why does she come back here? How does these sibling children of hers fit into this?
Mm.
The grandfather, we know they're in Allen Street. You've got you've got a physical locality that we can all relate to.
Yeah.
And a convict era, when I was growing up, no one wanted to even hint at the possibility of having a
We didn't
convict.
Talk about convicts.
Didn't talk about them.
Not at all.
Today, of course, we've had premiers who've got antecedents who were.
Yeah.
We've got people who proudly state it. And no great division between a convict ancestor or a settler ancestor.
That's right.
And you've told this beautiful story, which really isn't all focused on all of that dark and gloom, though Edwin has this terrible past.
Mm.
Now, he came from where? The north of England.
He came from Lichfield, which is near Birmingham, in the Midlands, so right in the middle. And
if you watch Peaky Blinders,
dad loves Peaky Blinders, and he tells me I would like it, but I'm not great with violence, so
well,
so I haven't quite got there yet.
It's a bit gratuitous,
even though I've written a story about some terrible things, I'm not great with violence.
So,
yeah.
And you came from, generally speaking, the north of England.
I did.
When you were young, with your
parents. I did. Yeah.
So, how did you imagine or discover the sort of life he may have been living there and what its, I don't know, what its contours would have been like, which led to him coming here as a convict?
I was one of the great benefits of the PhD was that I did also get a tiny pocket of money to go to the UK and do proper research over there. So I went to, apart from the lovely stuff that you do at, you know, places like the National Archives in Kew in London, which is full of Australians looking into their family past. It was a fantastic environment.
Yes, but they're looking for a convict.
Well, they really wanted to know where their families came from. So it's I think it's a real drive to know where we came from. Edwin lived in Lichfield, which is was a coaching town just near Birmingham. And so I went there and I spent quite a bit of time there. I walked the streets of Lichfield. I walked the streets where they would have all lived. I walked up to the wonderful cathedral. I spent a lot of time just laying around on the lawn in front of the cathedral and daydreaming. I looked in all the graveyards. I just immersed myself in the place and also did some reading about the town. So I discovered that Lichfield was a coaching town, and the coming of the railways, which was a big deal in the mid 19th century across the whole of Britain in the Victorian era, the coming of the railways completely transformed the town and what it was there for. And I'd done a lot of travel on. I love train travel myself, especially in the UK. I never drive when I'm there. I always just catch trains everywhere, and I love that, just sitting by the window and staring at this. You see a different side of Britain. You see the more industrial side. You see the shabbier side when you travel on the train routes. And that's what I really loved about my trips there. Have always done ever since I was younger. And so I had kind of, again, this is where the imagination kind of kicked in. I'd known that Edwin was a bright student. He was a reader. He'd brought books with him from the UK, books and letters. He had been appointed what they called the reading monitor on board the ship when he was out here, when he was being transported. So he was a literate man. And I imagined what it might be like for a literate man watching his town change, watching his father's business decline because of the changes that he could do nothing about, industrial changes. And I just imagined this idea of this really bright young man who had possibilities in his future. And of course, I'd known what happened. You know, his life went really, really wrong. And so what I did in the writing was I tried to explore creatively how could somebody, in a way, it's quite an old story, very promising young man. How can it go so wrong? And I tried to explore that in the creativity, and being in Lichfield really helped me. I loved the town. Samuel Johnson was born there. Apart from its lovely genteel, the cathedral and the churches, in the town square, St Mary's Square in Lichfield, they have plaques all around the square that tell you about all of the people who were burned for being witches, all of the people who were hanged and the crimes. So it's got this kind of blue plaques of brutality kind of in the middle of this genteel place. And I loved that contrast. And I just kind of immersed myself in the place. And I'm the kind of writer that really does need to be, if something has happened in a place, I need to know the place well enough to write about it. I can't really do it from a distance.
Edwin didn't stay in Lichfield, though, did he?
No, he didn't. He began as a tailor, like his father. And I had imagined that his father would want him to take over the family business. But Edwin becomes an excise man. He goes to work for the customs and excise department, as many men did. And it was a promise back in the 19th century that was the kind of opportunity to get out of the trades and into a clerical profession, kind of get a class upgrade, if you like. And I went in the National Archives. I was able to find his employment record with the customs department, and he was transferred. He moved around all the time.
Amazing.
They were shifted like just pawns. They were just moved around to suit the bureaucracy. Whenever there was a vacancy somewhere, they just moved a man from wherever. It didn't matter about the distance. They just put people where they needed people in a very seemingly arbitrary way.
Well, across the United Kingdom.
That's right, across the entire, the length and breadth of the UK and Ireland. And so Edwin moved around a great deal in that dozen or so years.
Well, we won't tell the readers too much about what actually happens, because you keep guessing and you keep wondering and you keep getting there. One thing I've discovered a lot about recently, for some reason, is how popular gin was before I discovered gin and tonics a few years ago. But it seems to have been a real lush drink for a long time.
Well, I think it was a cheap drink, wasn't it? It was the cheap drink for the masses back in the day. It's had an image upgrade in the intervening 150 years, I think. But there was a very strong drinking culture, and all of the a lot of the documents I read around Edwin's crime were about basically everybody was drinking all of the time. He was a heavy drinker, and it obviously got the better of him on more than one occasion. And same in Western Australia, he had one conviction, I think just one conviction, for drunken disorderly after he'd arrived here. But that was very common offence. Magistrates were always sending people to prison here in the early days for being drunk and disorderly. So it was a pervasive part of the culture, and I think Edwin was no different to many others in that regard.
Yes, I love the way the book, from memory, it's in the East Perth, Derbal Yerrigan part
yes,
of the
that's
world,
right.
where
yep.
where Agnes. Meets the local Noongar people.
Yes.
And it just reminds you that in the era when it's set, it's hardly 50 years after the settlers first arrived in this colony.
Mm.
It's just so recent, isn't it? Mind you, we're not even 200 years now.
Well, this is a really interesting point, because to write, I believe that if you're writing anything that is about the early years of settlement, which we really should call more accurately occupation, but is what routinely referred to as settlement. If you're writing now, finally, I think as a culture, and I think Western Australia has come very late to this, we do acknowledge that it was a frontier and that there was frontier violence. We finally are acknowledging that and looking squarely in the face of that, those events and the consequences as a culture. So I think anyone writing today about events that happened back in the early days of the colony, I think it would be remiss not to acknowledge that past in some way. And so I wanted to, and yet at the same time, it's just in the official records, it's just about impossible to find anything that's meaningful about Aboriginal occupation of the land. So I wanted to acknowledge that history. Some of it is troubling. There's a couple of events in the book that allude to that. But I wanted to, in an appropriate way, appropriate for the world of the novel, but also appropriate for me as a white English immigrant writing about times gone by, I wanted to acknowledge and include a presence of Noongar people in the lives of the East Perth community at that time. And so I did that. There is a presence all the way through. And the first thing Edwin does when he gets his land is he builds a fence. And he does that because fence building is the thing that says to the world and to yourself, this is what's mine and this is what isn't yours. And there are those scenes in the book where Edwin talks about, he's very irritated, he hates it, he's a bit of a racist, and he talks about the Aboriginal people camping on his land.
I mean, the irony is in uppercase.
Exactly. He talks about the Aboriginal people camping on his land and continually breaking through the fence. And he says at one point, you'd think they had a right to it. And so I've done this not to be a kind of, I think it's true to the world of the novel. I think it would have been very remiss not to acknowledge any kind of Noongar presence at all in East Perth, because that's just not how it was.
Well, it wasn't how it was, and yeah. Blaisbrook was an important street.
Yes, that's right.
Sharon, we're reaching the end of this lovely discussion, and speaking of remiss, it would be remiss of me not to ask you, what's in the pipeline? Is there more historical fiction?
Well, I don't know about... it's funny because I've The Silence of Water is historical fiction.
Yes.
But I have always... I never call it historical fiction to myself. I see it more as a family story that just happens to be set in the past. I've always thought that it would appeal also to read people that wouldn't normally pick up historical fiction might like this book because of its focus on family secrets, which, let's face it, not every family has a convict, but I'm pretty sure every family has a few secrets. So what's next is I'm kind of working on two things at the same time. One of them is, in the course of doing my PhD, I again going down a few research rabbit holes, I discovered a few women writers, women novelists, Western Australian writers, who are now all but forgotten. And I really liked what bits of their work I was able to read. And I would like to, so I'm kind of working on something that will perhaps bring their work and their lives back to a wider audience in some way, although it's very vague at the moment. I came out of the starting blocks really confident when I was first asked this question about what's next, and the more I talk about it, the less confident I am. But I'm doing that because I really do believe that there's this little kind of, there's this pocket of, again, in the State Library, you know, in the State Records Office, there's this kind of pocket of aspect of our history that nobody knows about, and I think we should know about it. And it's interesting, especially because it's women. And I'm also looking at I've just started messing about with a new novel that is, it's not historical fiction, but it is set in the more recent past, and still looking at those themes of immigration and disconnection from home, which I think is something that I've probably got a few more things I have to say about that myself as a writer before I'm done.
Well, let me conclude by complimenting you again. The Silence of Water is much more than what people sometimes even pejoratively refer to as historical fiction. It's a lovely story, it's well meted, it's delicate. It just happens, as it turns out, to involve some people who historically were real.
Yeah.
But the rest of it is imagined lives, mm. And as it could be for any of us. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Look forward to
Thanks.
What comes next.
Hopefully it won't take me quite as long.
See ya.
Thank you.